I wonder if you've ever had something meticulously planned and prepared, and then it all goes horribly wrong. There's one or two in the congregation tonight who are feeling perhaps a little bit like that. Everything was organized. Just a quick run through, 10 or 15 minutes before the service, and everyone would have known what they were doing. And then the preacher turns up late, and no one's quite sure anymore. Well, if that's how we feel tonight, how much more did Herod feel that back in Matthew chapter 2? He thought he had everything under control. He thought that everything was sorted. He'd managed to get himself into the most powerful position in the land. He'd been installed there by the Romans. Although he was the king of Judea, he wasn't really a king. He wasn't from a noble line. But he'd managed through some devious moves and through violence where necessary and through buttering up the right people, he'd managed to get the Romans to install him as king. He had it all planned. He'd done away with the priestly caste to make sure that they couldn't usurp him or preach against him. He'd done away with his own wife. Not just divorce, he'd done that. He had more wives than Henry VIII did Herod. He had 9 wives, but he'd done away with his wife. He'd had her killed. He'd had his sons killed and his sons-in-law killed and various other members of his family who he thought might be a threat. He thought he had it all sorted. And now he could enjoy his reign in peace. And then suddenly one day, some wise men from the east turn up on his doorstep. Rulers from a distant land. They've not come for war. Perhaps he could have coped with that. Perhaps he could have raised an army to fight against them. Maybe he would even have enjoyed doing that. But the wise men came not to start a war, but to worship a king. The problem, as far as Herod was concerned, is that it wasn't him. How would you have reacted if you were Herod? Gone to all this trouble, at so much cost, to secure your rule and kingship, and then these great, powerful Eastern leaders turn up saying, Matthew chapter 2, verse 2, "Where is he who has been born King of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the East and have come to worship him." Well, Herod didn't get where he was by overreacting. Herod didn't get where he was by acting on the spur of the moment and maybe getting things wrong. He was a plotter. He was a conniver. He was someone who played his cards very carefully. And he had this idea. He'd get together, first of all, the religious leaders. Try and find out what these guys are talking about. This star, this king of the Jews, this baby that's been born, what are they talking about? So the religious leaders, the verse 4, the chief priests and the scribe, they gather together, and Herod asks them, where was it that the Christ, the Messiah, the promised one that is to be born? And they knew the answer. In Bethlehem, in Judea. And they know the answer because, as they said here in verse 5, a prophet in the Old Testament, hundreds of years prior to Jesus being born, a prophet called Micah had said so. It's going to be in Bethlehem, in the land of Judah. It's a small little town, a village even. But out of this little village is coming a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. Well, Bethlehem's only a few miles away from Jerusalem, so that was straightforward enough. And then Herod, secretly, can you see verse 7? This is just typical of Herod. He liked to do things in secret. So he calls the wise men secretly, finds out what time, how long ago the star appeared. That's going to come in handy later on, for him at least. And he sends them to Bethlehem. He doesn't send soldiers with them, doesn't want to overdo it, doesn't want to cause a fuss, would rather nobody knew about this king who'd been born in Bethlehem, you might think. Go and find him, he says. And when you've found him, tell me where he is so that I can come and worship him too. So the wise men listen to the king, and they go down into Bethlehem, and the star that they've been following moves somehow, and so they know exactly where to go. And they go in to the house, verse 11, where the young child is with Mary. And they fall down and worship him. They give their great gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. And Herod, no doubt, is sitting back at his palace, more than a little worried, and more than a little perplexed. But it's okay. It's under control. And once these wise men come back, as they will do very soon, a soldier can be dispatched, an assassin can set out, and my kingship will be safe again. There's one problem, of course. Herod doesn't make any allowance for God, does he? So can you see what happens in verse 12 to the wise men? Then, being divinely warned in a dream that they should not return to Herod, they departed for their own country another way. Herod thought it was all under control, but he hadn't accounted for God. As the story goes on, Herod finds out now that he's been thwarted in his plans. So what does he do now? Verse 16, we didn't read it, but I'll read it now. When he saw that he was deceived by the wise men, he was exceedingly angry. He sent forth and put to death all the male children who were in Bethlehem and in all its district, from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had determined from the wise men. He's not going to be thwarted, is this Herod. He's not going to let anything stand in his way. He's going to make sure that he is secure and his rule is secure. And so he kills anybody who might get in his way, even these innocent little babies. And we can presume from this, can't we, that these wise men have been traveling for perhaps 18 months. I'm sure Herod would have erred on the side of safety and setting it out. 2 years old, he's going to kill everybody under that age to make sure he gets this king. But he's forgotten about God again, hasn't he? Because in the verses in between, go back a little bit to verse 13. Now when they had departed, that's the wise men, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, arise, take the young child and his mother, flee to Egypt, and stay there until I bring you word, for Herod will seek the young child to destroy him. You see, it wasn't Herod who had everything under control, it was God. And God demonstrates this and proves this to us. Matthew proves it to us by constantly throughout this chapter of referring to Old Testament passages. Passages in the Bible that were written hundreds of years before these events that predict what's going to happen. So the fact that Jesus ends up in Egypt is a prophecy there in Hosea in the Old Testament, and it's fulfilled for us in verse 15. And the fact that Herod kills all those babies, that comes from Jeremiah chapter 31, and it's fulfilled, therefore, is in verse 18. And so it goes on. It's not Herod that's in control, it's God. Now, there's some simple things that we can learn from this passage, just very quickly, as we think about the Christmas story. Because these passages tell us not only about Herod and what a fool he was for thinking he was in control when really it was God who was in control, they also tell us some things about Jesus. Let me tell you briefly what they are. The first thing that this passage teaches us is it shows us that Jesus is a great king. Jesus is a great king. Here are these wise men, magi, we sometimes call them. That was how they would have described themselves in their own language, magi. They were from Persia or Iran. They were great leaders in their country. They were powerful men. They were wise men. They knew nothing, probably, of the Old Testament or of the Bible. They may not have known anything at all about the God of the Bible. But somehow, they saw this star in the sky and they knew what it meant. The Savior had been born in the West. and they packed up their camels, we presume, and they set out on this great journey, 800 miles or more across the deserts, to see this baby, bearing these great gifts of gold and of frankincense and of myrrh. Why set out on such a journey? Why not send an envoy? Why go yourself, that journey that would have taken several months to go there and to come back? Oh, they wanted to go because they knew how important it was to make that journey. Why was the journey so important? Because the one they were going to see was a great king. A great king. And we know that they realize he was a great king because when they find him, verse 11, they fall down and worship him. Can you imagine these foreign leaders coming, bowing down and worshipping this little child? But that's what they did. They brought gifts suitable for a king. In the Old Testament, one of the greatest kings who was there in the Old Testament is a king called Solomon. And he was the wisest of all the Old Testament kings. He was the richest of all the Old Testament kings. And we find at different points in the story that there are people who travel great distances, other leaders, the Queen of Sheba being the most famous, who travels up to see Solomon bearing gifts of gold and of spices, just like these gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh. She goes, but she goes not to worship Solomon, but she goes to test him and to see whether he really is as wise as she's been told. She goes away admiring Solomon, but never worshipping him. But here is Jesus, you see, who goes one better than the wisest king of the Old Testament, of the richest king of the Old Testament, because Jesus is not just good, or Jesus is not just great, but he is the greatest. He is utterly unique. And these wise men help us to see it. The second thing that these wise men do for us is that they show us that Jesus Christ is for everyone. That Jesus Christ is for everyone. There were lots of people around in these days who thought that when the Messiah, the promised one, would come, he would only be for the Jews, not for anybody else. And he would rescue the Jews, and he would do good for the Jews, but he wouldn't be for anyone else. But what you get in Matthew's story, isn't it interesting? The Jews who are in this section, how do they respond to Jesus? Well, you have Herod, who's kind of half a Jew, and he hates Jesus and wants to kill him. Then you've got the chief priests, the religious rulers. They're the ones that you'd have thought would have really been interested in the promised one of God. And they seem not to be bothered at all. You don't see them going out to Bethlehem to find this child, do you? I mean, if they really believe this prophecy, if they really believed it, surely they'd have gone, but they seem not to. They're just indifferent to what's going on. But it's these foreigners, these non-Jews, Gentiles we call them. It's they who come and worship. Now, Matthew's not being anti-Semitic here at all. It's impossible to accuse the gospel writers of being anti-Semitic when we remember that Jesus was a Jew. It's impossible to be anti-Semitic. But what he's saying here is that some of the people who you might have expected to respond well to Jesus didn't do. And the foreigners who you'd have thought wouldn't have responded well, they did. And again, this isn't exactly what we should expect if we know our Bible, because the Old Testament tells us that when the promised one comes, kings will come from different places and will come bearing great gifts. So they show us that Jesus Christ is not just for one small group of people, but Jesus Christ is for everyone. And of course that means that Jesus Christ is for us here tonight too. The third thing that the wise men help us to understand, they help us to see that Jesus is a great king. They help us to see that Jesus Christ is for everyone. But they really help us to see that people respond to Jesus in lots of different ways. People respond to Jesus in lots of different ways. We've hinted at this already, haven't we? You've got these three very different ways in which people respond to Jesus here in this passage. You've got Herod, who hates him. The priests, who are indifferent to him. And then you have the wise men themselves who worship him. And you see, that's exactly what Jesus has done right throughout the centuries, right throughout the millennia. Because this is an ancient story, as you know, but Jesus isn't just confined to history. Because today, still, as you know and are experiencing now, the gospel of Jesus Christ is still being preached. And Jesus is still being shared with men and women and boys and girls literally all around the world. And men and women and boys and girls are being invited to respond to Jesus Christ. They're being confronted with the claims of Jesus. And when that happens, we have to respond, don't we? When that happens, we have to decide for ourselves, well, who was this Jesus? Who is this Jesus? And Matthew explains to us here that he's a great king. And he shows us that he's absolutely unique, that there's nobody like him. And if you were here this morning, you'll know that in the first chapter of Matthew's Gospel, he shows us how Jesus is both like us, but totally not like us at all. He's both human, he's a human being, just like us, but he's also fully God, not like us. He's the God-man, and he brings this two natures together, and that makes him completely unique. And it means that as we're responding to Jesus, that we can't kind of respond to him in the way that we respond to others. He's in a special category all of his own. This great king. Well, why was it that Herod hated him? Why was it that Herod wanted to do him evil? Well, part of the reason, to be frank, is just that Herod was an evil man. And evil was in his nature. That's how he dealt, and that's how he responded to problems, with violence first. So part of it was that. But just as importantly, he hated Jesus because he hated anyone who would challenge him. He ruled the show as far as he was concerned. He called the shots. And nobody was going to come and tell Herod how he should live and what he should do. And we find exactly the same in our own generation, don't we? I know many people who would read the Bible and who would read the things that Jesus says. I said, I'm not going to have somebody telling me how to live my life. I'm not going to have someone rule in my life. I'm in charge. I'm going to do what I want to do. And I'm not going to have God or Jesus Christ rule over me. Many would respond in that way today. Maybe you would respond in that way yourself. Maybe you're happy to come to church at Christmas and a few other times of the year. Maybe you're happy to come every week. But you don't want Jesus to actually change your life. You don't want Jesus to actually rule over you and to guide you. You don't want to ask yourself every day when you wake up, not what do I want today, but what does God want me to do today? You don't want that. And therefore, like Herod, you reject Jesus Christ. You push him away. You want nothing to do with him. Well, if that describes you this evening, then maybe you need to look again at what happened to Herod. You need to remind yourself that although he thought he was in control, he wasn't at all. And God was in control all of the time. And when we push God away and when we try and put ourselves so that we're in control, we're fooling ourselves. Because God is in control and God calls the shots and God pulls the strings. And he really is in charge of us, whether we admit it or not. Let's look at the priests and their religious leaders then. They were the ones who knew everything in their heads, didn't they? They knew what the Old Testament says. They knew when the Messiah was to be born. They knew that it would be in Bethlehem. They knew all that. They had all the information up here. But it didn't seem to change their lives at all. And they responded in apathy. They didn't seem to care. They were happy to talk to Herod. They were happy to give the information. But they weren't going to do anything. And again, so it is with so many people today. So many people I know who are religious, and they know what the Bible says by and large. They could quote different bits that they've remembered from Sunday school or from RE lessons in school, or maybe even they've read themselves. And they know all about the Bible. And they know all about Christianity, and they know the facts. And they could tell you that Jesus was born in Bethlehem, and they could tell you that he died on a cross. They could tell you all kinds of things like that. But it doesn't change them at all. They just go on living their lives as if they didn't know those things. And maybe that describes you this evening. Maybe you've grown up in a church setting. Perhaps you can remember back to Sunday school days, forced to put on your Sunday best and packed off to church. Maybe you enjoyed it. Maybe you didn't. And you remembered the stories, some of them fondly. And you remember what the Bible says, and some of it you think is really interesting, and some of it you think is really good. But it doesn't really change the way you live. And you're not really thinking about Jesus or God. You just take the bits from the Bible that you like and approve of. And you'll keep to those. But Jesus, as King, ruling my life, that's for fanatics. Not for me. Well, if that describes you tonight, perhaps it would be good for you to remember what happened to the chief priests and the scribes and the others who were described here. Because as you probably remember from your Sunday school days, as the Gospel of Matthew and the other Gospels go on, the chief priests and the scribes find themselves in greater and greater opposition to Jesus Christ. And the apathy can't last. Because they have to choose one way or the other. And eventually these people will choose not on the side of Jesus, but they'll choose to oppose him. And that's what will happen to you too if you remain apathetic. You'll keep gently just pushing away, and over time, maybe without you even noticing, you'll be drifting long, long away from the shore. What happened to these chief priests and scribes? They opposed Jesus. They thought they'd won. Had him killed on the cross. They thought they were in control. They didn't realize that was part of Jesus' plan too, of God's plan too. They didn't realize that God the Father had sent Jesus Christ to be born in order that he might die. And they didn't understand that as Jesus Christ hung there on the cross, he was dying in the place of every man and woman and boy and girl who will ever put their trust in him. And in doing so, he was bringing condemnation too on all those who refuse to believe. It's a dangerous business to oppose Jesus Christ. And then, of course, we have the wise men. These people who it would have seemed on the surface are not the type of people to go worshipping, and not the type of people to travel all the way to Judea to worship this king, out of character altogether. But you know, very often in the Bible, it's just the people who you think are not the ones who will come to Jesus. It's them who come. And that's exactly what many people have found here tonight. That really, if we examine ourselves, we're not the people who would come to Jesus. We're not the people who really think that are the typical ones who might come. But God, in his grace and in his goodness, calls even those. And it may be that you're here tonight and you think, well, I'm not the sort of person who gets religious. I'm not the sort of person who comes to Jesus. Well, maybe that means that Jesus is just for you. Maybe that means that Jesus is calling you to come and to worship him. Maybe that means that Jesus is calling you to acknowledge your sin and your unworthiness. Maybe he's calling you to tell him that you're not really good enough to come. That you're not really worthy. That you're not really the sort of person that you think he's looking for. Oh, but oh, you want to come. Oh, you want to worship. Oh, you want to bow down and you want him to be king, and you're fed up of trying to go your own way. You want to follow Jesus. And maybe Jesus is calling you, even tonight, to ask forgiveness, to ask for faith, so that this Christmas might be the first Christmas where, just like these wise men, you worship Jesus for who he is.